Maintenant, place à la présentation de Andrea, qui est critique et artiste entre du coup Berlin et New York. Et voilà, et je te laisse commencer ta présentation. Voilà, c'est à toi.
Merci, merci. Merci aux organisateurs et tout le monde. Je suis désolée d'avoir raté ma place ce matin. Je devais me prendre l'avion de Berlin. Lorsque j'ai initialement proposé la présentation, mon idée, c'est de la faire en français, mais je n'ai pas eu le temps de faire une traduction très précise. Par conséquent, je vais faire ma présentation en anglais. J'espère que ça ne posera un problème pour tout le monde. D'accord. Michel de Certeau's The Practice of Everyday Life is premised upon a stark binary between strategy and tactic. A strategy is for the powerful. It entails agency, volition, foresight. A tactic is for the weak, something ad hoc, improvisational, reactive. Quoting de Certeau, the place of a tactic belongs to the other. Thus, it must play on and with a terrain imposed on it and organized by the law of a foreign power. A tactic insinuates itself into the other's place fragmentarily. It has at its disposal no base where it can capitalize on its advantages. Because it does not have a place, a tactic depends on time. Whatever it wins, it does not keep. For de Certeau, strategy comes from above. A tactic comes from below. According to him, they even have different temporalities. Tactic can only unfold in reaction to things happening in real time, whereas strategy is more eternal and static. In delineating what a tactic is, de Certeau uses the example of how indigenous Indians, while seeming to consent to their subjugation by Spanish colonizers, still made use of rituals and laws imposed on something completely, something different, if not even hostile to what their conquerors had in mind. Perhaps this recontextualization of an object by the weak against a system of meaning constructed by the powerful can be applied to the use of the safety pin by punk styles of dress. A safety pin, normally something anodyne, utilitarian, sensible, sterile, during the punk era was proliferated with cancerous overgrowth. Their appearance reproduced with a multiplicity outside of rationality or function, with leather jackets or outerwear lined with safety pins, almost resembling the stitches one would have on one's body from a scar or the legs of a centipede. The use of the safety pin in punk clothing becomes almost a talismanic object. It seems like the gateway to some enigmatic, very powerful, yet completely esoteric ontology or circle of meanings of some community which remains invisible and hidden from public, but only peeks its head out in the form of the appearance of safety pins. Dick Hebdige talks about violations of the authorized codes through which the social world is organized, having considerable power to provoke and disturb. He cites Mary Douglas when she talks about how they are conceived as contrary to holiness and condemned, citing Levi Strauss, saying in certain primitive myths, the mispronunciation of words and the misuse of language are classified along with incest as horrendous aberrations. De Certeau's conception of a tactic can be applied to certain forms of countercultural clothing, which function almost as a form of semiotic guerrilla warfare. That's a phrase from Umberto Eco. Hebdige's subculture, the meaning of style, we had another presentation earlier that referenced him. This talks about how the signifying power of punk subculture and its transgression of sartorial codes as an assault on the syntax of everyday life, which dictates the ways in which the most mundane objects are used. He calls punk clothing a sartorial equivalent of a swear word. Unlike Barth mythologies, which are ways of thinking and doing that masquerade as nature and presented as a timeless static inevitability, punk disrupted smooth signification and turned the naturalization of roles inside out, bringing to mind Telltale's attempt to problematize the positivistic assumptions of a transparent relation between signifier and signified. Now let's just review what does that mean, problematizing the relationship between the signifier and the, I'm sure everybody already knows this, but let me just, So as we all know, the signified, so if you have a tree, the abstract concept of the tree is the signified, an actual word, the phonetic sound when you say tree or it is that the actual word, and that's a signifier, and the signified and the signifier together comprise a sign that's from Saussure, and he talks about how this relationship is arbitrary. So you know, if you have a let's say you have a condensed graphic of a man wearing a suit, and that represents the man's bathroom, right? And then you have a little small graphic of a woman with a skirt, and that represents the woman's bathroom. So that little picture of the woman with the skirt is the signified, and the abstract idea of the woman's bathroom is the signifier. And so in these cases, the relationship, like for instance, the woman's bathroom sign, the relationship of the signifier and the signified is smooth, and it's unproblematic. And the argument is that Punk problematized this relationship, and Punk created a friction between the signifier and the signified. And this friction is at the heart of what Vivian Westwood, she's a British fashion designer who was at the center of punk fashion in the 1970s, what she calls confrontation dressing, where there is a rupture between the natural and constructed context. She's known for distressed forms of fashion, amongst many other things, like army combat gear, motorcycle fetish wear, zippered seams under the crotch, and removable bum flaps. In theorizing punk clothing, it is apparent that two schools of thought emerge, one that descends from CC, Center for Cultural Studies, Birmingham in the 1970s, and Stuart Hall, that looks at punk dress through the lens of semiotics, Gramscian hegemony, and Marx-based class analysis, a macro analysis whereby subcultural style is construed essentially as a power struggle between different groups or different norms in society. Then the other school, which is more rooted in performance studies and affect theory, which looks at punk clothing as a staging of the abject body, clothing as performance of ritualized identity, and an emphasis on the body as a critical site of resistance. The second school has often criticized the first school of being too monolithic, too one-size-fits-all, too universalizing, and for completely forgetting the particularistic conditions of a body when discussing fashion, and instead interpreting fashion in terms of, you know, overarching macro-sociological analysis of large groups of people. So my research began as a comparison of these two conflicting approaches and their different emphases and conclusions, as well as research into punk's influence or affinities with Harajuku. Harajuku in Tokyo is from mid-1990s to end of 2010s. Is a term used to describe teenagers dressed in a fashion style in the neighborhood of Harajuku in Tokyo. These teenagers dress in outlandishly colorful outfits that correspond to certain roles. Punk, kawaii, that means cute, cosplay, visual K, Uzahara, goth, sailor suit, funeral goer. Japanese kimonos are mixed with Scottish plaids and Hello Kitty handbags. Outfits replete with rainbow-colored clashing stripes, plaids, polka dots, floral prints, platform boots, plastic trinkets, double and triple handbags, and floppy hats. Dans les années 1980, que Harajuku est devenu célèbre grâce aux artistes de rue et aux animateurs qui apparaissent près de la gare le dimanche, et que la rue Takeshita près de la gare a été bordée des magasins à la mode pour adolescents. Le point chaud le plus était Urahara. On y trouve de petites boutiques et des magasins tenus par des jeunes artistes, et ce quartier est connu pour être la porte d'entrée de l'industrie de la mode japonaise traditionnelle. La culture de Urahara est encore très marginale et possède une atmosphère underground distincte de la scène traditionnelle. Dans ce monde souterrain, les informations sur les nouveaux produits sont diffusées de bouche à oreille. Contrairement au grand quartier de la mode à Tokyo, il n'y a pas eu de stratégie particulière pour investir et développer la petite zone de Urahara. Le secteur de la mode de Urahara se compose de boutiques dites sélectives qui vendent des marques mineures conçues par des stylistes semi-professionnels et des artistes, tels que des graphistes et des textile designers. Il existe également un certain nombre de projets de collaboration entre les marques, les magasins et les artistes. Selon Kensuke Kojima, certaines des caractéristiques unique de l'industrie de la mode Harajuku. Un, il n'y a pas de structure organisationnelle pour l'entreprise, comme l'établissement de budget annuel ou de stratégie promotionnelle. Deux, il considère le processus de fabrication, proprement dit, extrêmement important. Et beaucoup de temps est investi dans la planification et le marchandisage. Et ces articles sont vendus en petite quantité. Trois, il ne s'inquiète pas des tendances dominantes et sont satisfaits tant que leurs propres styles uniques sont acceptés au sein de leur propre communauté. Ils se soucient plus de l'innovation et de la créativité que du profit. What Harajuku and punk clothing have in common is, number one, both form a subcultural community around a style of dress. They dress in a way to mark themselves as a social dropout. Number two, both shatter the hierarchy between producer and consumer. In both punk and Harajuku, the producer is the consumer of the fashion. Normally, there's a clear division of labor, and the occupational categories are tightly controlled. And this is almost reminiscent of, if any of you know, Paulo Freire and his seminal work, Pedagogy of the Press. It talks about a traditional education system that sees the education as top-down, where students are seen as empty bank accounts, that teachers have to just deposit money, and learning is only unilateral. And that's sort of how the producer of fashion and the consumer of fashion, that's what the relationship was like. But punk and Harajuku, they changed that so that the consumer of fashion is sort of an active producer of fashion also. Number three, both are what Vivienne Westwood called confrontation dressing. Dress where, I discussed that before, dress where there's rupture between natural and constructed context. Number four, both are experimental urban street clothing as a form of visual resistance and dissident subjectivity, a type of anti-fashion, a rebuke to the conventional fashion system. The subcultural bricoleur, like the author of a surrealist collage, when Hebdegi talks about the surrealist collage juxtaposes two incompatible realities on an unsuitable scale, creating an explosive junction, which applies to both Harajuku and punk. And number six, both punk and Harajuku, they mix and match temporal periods. They confuse chronological sequence by mixing up details from different periods. Punk reproduced the entire sartorial history of post-war working class youth cultures in cut-up form, combining elements which had originally belonged to completely different epochs. Then Harajuku uses Victorian dress, a lot of throwback to, a simpler time. There's a lot of homage to the past in Harajuku, and it's all very postmodern, bricolage, pastiche, indiscriminate juxtaposition of different temporal periods. These are all quintessential postmodern traits. So number seven is the last one. Both can be interpreted as a subconscious palimpsest or reaction to particular historical metamorphoses or rapid transitions in their society. So number seven is probably my most ambitious claim. It's the one I'm gonna have to do the most heavy lifting to convince people. I think number one and six are pretty self-evident. I feel pretty convinced I can convince people of those. Now, let me just say something. So in terms of, before I get to my conclusion, which is coming very soon, let me just say something quickly about, in terms of historical conditions within their society. So I just want to say something. This is sort of a little blurb. So it's a little fashion talk here now. When we look at, certain fashions, how fashions, I'm talking about women's fashions, I guess, reinforce a sort of heterosexual normativity. We can see in Christian Lacroix, that's the most traditional, like she had these bubble dresses that were sort of very traditional, heterosexual female identity. Then you have something in the middle, and I would put people like Giorgio in the middle, meaning, in how they relate to gender. Giorgio Armani and the Belgian designers like Dries Van Noten. Sorry, I don't have a picture of Dries Van Noten. That are sort of, they're not as flagrantly proposing a classical heterosexual model of dress. They're sort of more in the middle. And then you have Comme des Garçons, and which is a Japanese fashion designer, which is the most sort of flagrantly just flinging off anything to do with fashion and women, you know, female heterosexual identity. It's almost called a deconstructed clothing, where the clothing, it's not about a classical female shape or figure or something. It's almost about fashion being deconstructed. And so I see, when I say about historical, you know, number seven, the numbers, I see Harajuku as continuing in this sort of Japanese avant-garde conceptual, hyper-conceptual wing of fashion. By the way, the Harajuku people, they despise Comme des Garçons and, you know, Yoshi Yamamoto and all those, the famous, you know, because they think that they're already part of the canon and they're too famous and they want to, you know, Harajuku wants to be more underground. But, and the last thing I'll say before my conclusion, I think, is that there's a tremendous misreading in the West of Harajuku in terms of constantly sexualizing their interpretation, because a lot of them look like Lolita, and we even have Gwen Stefani, who used, she had something called Harajuku Girls, where she had backup dancers in her band that were dressed as the, you know, Harajuku, but they were almost, let's see what it's, one critic said, Stefani has taken the idea of Japanese street fashion and turned these women into modern day geisha. I don't have a picture of her, but she made them into these really hyper-sexualized sort of passive agents, and that was, I feel, a misreading of what the spirit of Harajuku was. So, okay, so finally, I'm good. This is my conclusion. I want to just end with throwing out, this is sort of, this is maybe like more like a brainstorm, but let me just throw this out. So I want to just maybe clear up or challenge some misconceptions. Number one, subcultures do not stand outside the reflexive circuitry of production and reproduction. Subcultures are at least in part representation of these mainstream representations, and so I'm sort of throwing a gauntlet at or challenging this sort of staunch purist idea that a subculture is some purist negation and it's totally uncontaminated and everything. Number two is, there's no reason to suppose that subcultures spontaneously affirm only the repressed reading or the, you know, the excluded reading, or they're always on the side of the marginalized. I mean, within a subculture, there is refusal, but there's also complicity and ambivalence, and it's quite complex. Number three, the notion that a subculture is lawless, or that it's, it's just complete freedom. You know, subcultures can be highly regimented, and, you know, they can be highly, strict. Each part is organically related to other parts, and is through the fit between them that the subculture member makes sense of the world. And finally, my last one is just agnosticism. And I want to discourage overdetermined readings. And by this, I mean, like, when a cultural theorist or something says, you know, this way of dress means that they were unhappy about post-war Britain's, you know, stagnating economy in the 1970s. And this way of dress proved that, you know, this person wants to challenge gender norms. I mean, there's three problems with this type of analysis. The first one is, okay, let's just take the most, you know, obvious one. Let's say I say, you know, This person's way of dress is challenging gender norms. Number one, does that person have the same gender norms as me? Because maybe he's challenging my gender norms, but we don't know what his or her norms are. Maybe it's not challenging her norms at all. Maybe it's actually in total, you know, synchronicity with his her norms. Number two, there's a confusion or a conflation of intention and effect, right? Or cause and effect, like. Maybe the effect of seeing this person dressing, it challenged my norms, but that may not have been their intention, okay? And number three is just that people, you know, they, culture theorists, they can say, oh, you know, I conducted 200 interviews with people who were dressed this way, and they all said that, you know, they were trying to challenge gender norms, so that must prove that it's true. And I would say to that presupposes that each person has lucidity, that when you ask them the reason for doing something, they know what the reason, that's very contrary to Foucault, right? He said the things that are most powerful, that we don't even recognize them, they're so internalized. So, you know, I would take with a grain of salt, you know, studies of so-and-so subculture where they all said such and such is my reason. So I'm arguing for agnosticism, to say, we don't really know what is the reason why somebody dresses this way, or and to sort of militate against these overdetermined readings. Because when you look at it objectively, the arguments for we don't really know are actually stronger than the arguments for we know, because there are so many variables. And and I just want to militate against this sort of overdetermined readings where it's cut and dry, and you know, this subculture did this means this, and this subculture did this and it means this. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Merci beaucoup. Là, ça, on sent que ça a été dur, là. Respire. Merci beaucoup. Je vais parler en français, oui, ça ne te dérange pas, ouais, pour éviter de... ça va être compliqué pour moi de... Je peux, mais...
Je peux prendre des questions en français. Malheureusement, ma compréhension de français n'est pas toujours 100% fiable, mais je vais essayer, et si j'ai besoin de switch en anglais...
Bon, on va essayer de parler du coup doucement pour que les questions soient bien comprises. Et puis n'hésite pas à switcher effectivement en anglais. Merci beaucoup d'avoir apporté l'approche sémiologique, effectivement, en reprenant les thèses de Hebdige, hein, comment ça permet aussi pour les acteurs de créer des occasions, pour en faisant ce bricolage des corps, de redonner du pouvoir en créant la subversion sur les codes déjà établis, c'est ce que j'ai cru comprendre. Effectivement, est-ce qu'il y aurait des questions sur ce sujet? Ah, on sent que toi, tu peux parler anglais en plus.
Bravo for your presentation, and I just wanted to add, it's just a remark. It's nothing to do criticism or anything like that. But music has always been associated with fashion. I mean, you can go back as much as 1920, and you'll see that you have a specific fashion for the kind of music that was played mm-hmm. back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the same thing every decade. So I think in the punk movement, there was a difference is at first, since it was a reverse, you know, compared to all what was done before, that in fact at the end of the 60s and beginning of the 70s, you didn't have really any fashion. And I must say, I can be proven wrong, but I think that Vivian herself, in fact, created a fashion, the punk fashion, which didn't really exist before, because it was not really what they were about, you know. So therefore, I think the safety pins and the mohawk and all this happened after Vivian, you know. Just a remark as far as the correlation between fashion and music.
Yeah, no, that's a great comment. I think it's like a chicken and egg question, right? Like, yeah, and so are you suggesting then that maybe this is too strong a word, co-opted, or that she, because she was seen, as you, I'm sure you know, as part of the punk, she had that store in London, I forget what it's called, and she, are you saying that you see her as some, imperialist is too strong a word, but like
yeah,
somebody,
because it was the couple between Malcolm and her.
Right.
And in fact, Malcolm had nothing to do with the music, and he had a store. So at first, when he started, it was just because he had a fashion store, not because it was the music. What happened is, and that has to be very noted, is that when the Heartbreakers, which Johnny Thunders, came to England, that's when all the kids in the audience thought that, hey, look, you know, I can do the same than these guys, because they thought it was very three chord, very simple, and that's where you had the birth of all the Sex Pistols and everything, but controlled by Malcolm and therefore Vivian, who had the store. So that's why I'm saying. I mean, they were there.
Yeah. It's a great point. It's sort of it's like we. Deciding between, like, is it symbiosis, is it parasitical, or is it it's interlocking, like a Mobius strip, sort of, like, the relationship between say, you know, a figure who is very prominent now. I don't know if people know, but now she's like a luxury brand. I mean, she's completely, but she's still, she's extremely, she's sort of like a Vanessa Redgrave of English fashion, where she's a really militant activist for, I think, for global warming or various other causes. And so she's, maybe we can call her Bobo, bourgeois bohemian, you know.
Well, let's start, go back to the start, you know, which is really, yeah, you know, that's quite important in our case.
Yeah, no, that's totally true, yeah, what you're saying, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? Alors, je ne sais pas, Andrea, si tu as vu le petit flyer, parce que ça va t'intéresser. Enfin, je ne sais pas si vous l'avez vu, d'ailleurs, hein, le dessin de Urbs. Je vais te le donner. Papa, maman, j'ai décidé de mettre un costume, c'est le fils des punks. Et les deux parents punks disent, oh merde.
D'accord. Oui, c'est moi. J'ai décidé.
Donc ça, challenging punk norms.
Oui, c'était yeah, pas tellement.
Je trouvais que ça allait bien avec ta communication sur... la subculture.
C'est très, très pertinent, merci. Oui. Non, c'est vrai que ce que vous avez dit, Laurent, c'est le vêtement, c'est une part indispensable avec la musique. Et, oui.
My example, it was the whole Puerto Rican, community, and that was the way for them. And the zoot suit is really a creation that came from the Latin side, especially in the New York scene. So every music, whatever it is, even if you listen to it later, you thought that, oh, this is just, you know, like classical music, you know. What you don't know is that Mozart, you know, maybe was dressed like mm-hmm. a punk, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
when
right.
he was,
yeah,
when
yeah,
he was
yeah.
doing things, you know. But all you got is what he has created. You don't have the visual of what was the. Mm-hmm. We only have the visual since the 1920s because yeah. that's when, you know, we get all the images and.
Yeah. That, yeah. Totally. No, thank you for that.
Okay. Merci beaucoup, Andrea. Je pense qu'on peut l'applaudir.